You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
Look, this might surprise you, but I have nothing in common with this person. And more than just the obvious things. The fact that I'm not like a predator. A lot of details where I'm like, ooh, we just wouldn't get along. Even if he wasn't a piece of shit. I have nothing to say to this person, honestly.
Hi, Jillian Bensavalli.
Hey, Patrick Hines.
Oh, my God, you guys. If you're looking for more shenanigans, join us on the Patreon, girl. Over 300 full ad-free bonus apps. Wait, we're into the Chippendales now.
Yeah, we're at the strip club. We're at Chippendales. Yeah. You said 300 bonus episodes. At least 200 of them were Relentless and Making a Murderer. We also did The Jinx, Lula Rich.
I love the people who in the Facebook group are like, I joined the Patreon just because I was seeing how much Relentless was such a shit show, and I just had to hear. You guys, if you want to become enraged about how a, quote, documentary filmmaker pursues a missing person, get into the Patreon and listen to our coverage of Relentless.
And also, it's like, it's almost the confusion is more than the rage. Yeah. It's like rage fusion. It was a weird thing where I didn't know what to feel or think. If you want to know more, I mean, that's where it is.
If you want to see a quote, documentary filmmaker grab a shovel and go into the woods to dig up a body, get into the Patreon.
The shade of it all. The way you like, quote, documentary. I see you, girl, with that quote.
Her name is Fontana, and in episode one, I was bye for Fontana, and then like by episode two, I was like, bye, Fontana.
But that was amazing. Let me tell you, you and I are both bye for Maggie.
I know. Oh, God. We are so bye for Maggie. You guys, don't forget, we're playing Broadway April 11th. If you are looking to sell your tickets, please go to the Facebook group, find the pinned post, and get in. There's hundreds of people looking for tickets. We are going to do a standby line day of. All I know is that every seat in that house better be fucking sat in. Join our Facebook group. Join us on the Instagram. I don't know. What else should we tell the people today?
I don't know. Just buckle up. Pull over. Whatever. Grab your water, your tea, your VOD, whatever you need to get through this shit show.
Here we go. All right, girl, tell the people what we're talking about today.
All right, we're talking about The Butcher Baker, Mind of a Monster on ID.
On the surface, Robert C. Hansen led a normal life.
We spent 2 days with this guy, looking right across from him like I am from you, across the table.
He ran a bakery downtown, a family man who liked to fly, liked to hunt.
Getting him to talk about what he'd been doing.
But Robert Hansen had a darker side.
I said, my God, Bob, what if it goes wrong again?
State troopers have said that up to 12 women could be victims.
I need help.
Bodies were dumped in shallow graves.
God, I want to help the damage my life. I found myself back uptown looking at the end. Damn, it's in it just like a moth drawing up a light. Scared me.
Immediately, we have a warning about graphic content and real crime scene photos, and just they're giving us trigger warnings right at the top here.
And boy, they are not kidding. Nary a blurred fucking crime scene photo in this entire thing.
Blur, it's so easy to do. The blurring, that's the thing. It's the easiest thing to do. You can be a little messy with it, color outside the lines, as they say. I don't know why they don't do it.
Wait, can I just say one quick thing talking about blurring? This week I was watching a YouTube video of like a chiropractor appointment where this like hot guy was rubbing down this other hot guy, but like showing you how to like alleviate back pain, and the guy being rubbed down was in his underpants and they were blurring his crotch, but you could see the crotch right through the blur.
See, this is what I'm saying. I don't... The people who want to blur, you don't have to. The people who should blur, they're not doing it. I'm confused about the blurring.
The blur job? You're confused about the blur job.
The blur job. Wait, didn't we say that earlier?
Yes,
what's that from?
I don't remember. That was from another episode where it's like, they're doing a terrible blur job. It's really not hard to give a good blur job, you guys.
Regardless, we have recordings of this piece of shit.
When you told me that you had these audio tapes, I was shocked because there was a deal made by representatives of the state of Alaska that these things would be kept private.
And look, if you're like me and you're just dying to get into a fucking true crime documentary made on television, all you gotta do is get some tapes. Like, if you can find some tapes of some serial killer talking about some shit, you're getting a documentary made. That's all you need.
Yeah, it helps.
Yeah, it really helps. And then I said, oh God, the murderer's a fucking baker. He, like, ran a bakery. Is this gonna be some Sweeney Todd shit?
These are probably the worst pies in London.
I really thought we were going to be dealing with him, like, baking the people into the pies.
Like, unclear cannibalism, like, when people don't know that they're eating. That's not a phrase.
Is that a thing?
Well, that's Sweeney Todd. They didn't know what they were eating in the pies.
Oh, God.
Anyway, his name is Robert Hansen, this guy, this piece
yes.
of shit.
Yes, and he owns a bakery, which honestly sounds like a great job. You know what I mean?
If you could do it, baking's hard. It's all in the timing, right? And the measurements. You can't really improvise with baking. You give me a pot of spaghetti, I'm like, oh, as much garlic as pot. You can really play yep. fast and loose yep. with the numbers and the measurements, not with baking.
No, uh-uh. It's science.
It really is. So we're at, it's Kinnick River. It's 40 miles north of Anchorage, Alaska.
I definitely wrote it as the Kink River. I was like, the Kink River?
That's what my eyes saw first. I was like, how unfortunate this is. We meet someone named Marshall, and his lower third is friend of the murderer. And then I said,
I know.
I'm assuming the former is implied, because if not, this isn't going to be fun for any of us.
I met Bob in 1978 through the church. Darla, his wife, approached us about coming to dinner and getting acquainted with Bob. She had indicated to me that he didn't have any friends, and would I be willing to consider being his friend?
Yeah, so he calls him Bob. His name is Robert, like Bob. And Bob loved flying and hunting. Immediately, we're not getting along. So I understand the hunting for necessity. But like, this guy has like a plane in Alaska, and he goes, like, he invades the space of the animals who live yeah. far away from the people, and then kills the animals. But this guy's like going into the middle of nowhere for like trophy kills, right? Which, not cool. So this Marshall guy is like,
my friend said, Marshall, you and I enjoy hunting because we enjoy the outdoors, we enjoy the stock, we enjoy the animals, whether we're shooting on them or not. He said, I don't think Bob is like that. I think he enjoys the kill.
And I just want to slow down on this for a second, because Marshall tells us that he met Robert through church, and it was really through Robert's wife, Darla, who begged him to be friends with her husband, the killer, because he has no fucking friends. She's like, I cannot get this guy out of my fucking house on a Friday night. Please come play with my husband. I need some alone time.
Now, normally, you know this would break my heart, right? Like, will you be my friend? No one's my friend.
I know.
But just don't feel bad for this guy. No spoilers, but hang tight.
It's called Butcher Baker. He's the baker.
Yeah, we don't want him to have any friends. At the very least, no. I want him to be friendless. I want a lot more to happen to him, but at the very least, lonely.
And also, Marshall says at one point, Bob invited him to go on his plane. And I just said, why would anybody do that? Unless your friend is a fucking pilot for Delta, why are you getting in their own personal fucking plane?
You know, my heart's like, oh my God, oh my God. My hands are shaking. I'm like a small rinky-dink plane with this guy.
Yeah.
But apparently, it's not that unusual to have a plane in Anchorage, Alaska, especially if you're a hunter.
I get it, but like, don't you have to take 800 hours of flight school? Are you telling me Bob did that? I feel like Bob doesn't know what he's doing up there.
I feel like he totally did.
Yeah.
Because he is on a mission and I hate him.
That's true. Marshall describes their like trips out to the outback to go hunting. They're like, you could be out there an entire day and not see another human. And I went, what is the appeal of this?
Fun.
Not a gay bar in sight out there in the Alaskan outback.
Like, what? What?
Oh, maybe we should make a gay bar called the Alaskan Outback.
Okay. See, now you're onto something. And it's got to be like cozy. It has to feel like a lodge, right?
Yes. So it's September 12th, 1982. We meet a guy named John Daly from the Anchorage Police Department. And he says, of course, he and his friend were going out moose hunting on the Kinnick River. Those poor fucking moose. What did they do to you?
I mean, they just stood there majestic as fuck. I mean, they look
being
a little silly. They have like kind of cartoony faces with the big antlers, but they're fucking cool. So he's there. They find some clothes and then a body, and it's a woman because, of course.
We got the state troopers out here. The odor of decomposition came out more and more as they started uncovering her. And you could see that it was a white female. There was something around the head.
They find this dead body. There's bandage tape wrapped around her entire head, including her eyes. It's horrible.
And you guys, like, they're showing us this crime scene photo of this body that they dug up. Like, they're not blurring this out. And I'm saying, like, it's horrible to look at, but, like, for the sake of the family, could you have a little respect?
I know that if they were here, they'd say, well, we want to show you how terrible he is. And it's like, you can use your words. Again, a well-placed blur goes a long way where I can understand how terrible this guy is, and I also won't have nightmares. Do you see?
You know that we're fans of the well-placed blur job, you guys. You know that we are.
It's all we ask.
So this is the first time we hear the tapes. Remember, this whole documentary is built around the idea that somebody, like, has these tapes of this interview with the serial killer. And it's Bob, the fucking butcher baker guy. And he's describing the abduction of this woman that whose body we've just seen in this hole.
Going out there, I did not want her to see where we was going and so forth. I guess maybe it made me feel masculine or powerful or in control of my life.
The thing that just was so bananas, he says the words, you know, abducting this woman made me feel powerful and masculine or in control of my life. To which I said, what are we doing to men that they feel so out of control of their fucking lives that they have to fucking kill people?
Let me tell you, they're doing it to their fucking selves. Like, they, like, unbelievable.
Yeah, I hope that you understand that was like a tongue-in-cheek, like, men, get your shit together.
This mediocre white dude, what are you so mad about? Anything you're so mad about, you have control over. I have the Italian hands. Now, and just shut up. And when I say mediocre,
I
mediocre is a compliment to this piece of shit. Totally. He is a dweeb through and through.
He's a herb. Would you describe him
as a herb? Lots of throwbacks in this ep already. I'm liking it. I taught Patrick what a herb was in, like, the last episode of The Vow that you can find on our Patreon feed. Mark Vicente is a herb.
Yes. So back at the crime scene, they're digging up the body. They find a shell casing. They tell us she had one gunshot wound to the heart.
So now we meet Susan, no last name. She is a former dancer, and Susan is here to tell us one hell of a story.
I was barely 18 when I first came to Anchorage. Very young, ignorant. I was a dancer for a club called Good Times.
Susan, who is a former dancer, looks like she was born to be a librarian. You know what I mean? She looks like a Tipton if ever I've seen a human being.
So Susan came to Anchorage when she was 18 years old. She says, I was young and ignorant. She then danced at a bar called Good Times, and she had a roommate named Sherry. And Sherry was great, lovely, soft-spoken, blonde. They shared outfits, and they were a support system for each other.
So put a pin in Susan. She's amazing. But, like, we meet this guy, Leland. He's an author. He actually wrote the book that this documentary is based on. And he gives us, like, background of Anchorage, which, like, Anchorage apparently was a boom town.
A lot of people came up to Alaska to take advantage of the quick money from the oil expansion. But with any boom town, where there's money and there's men, the women will follow.
Yeah, which is fine, I guess. But Leland, I have a bone to pick with Leland because he says, and I quote, like, with any boom town, where there's money and men, women will follow. Excuse you.
Leland.
What are you trying to say with that?
Totally.
What are you implying?
So he's saying that, like, the area of downtown called Fourth Avenue was, like, the red light district. I'm putting that in quotes.
No, it's, like, actually the red light district.
What does red light district mean? I don't get it.
It means where, like, the sex workers are.
Yeah.
And, like, the sex shops and the sex stuff and where you can get sex stuff.
Where you can get a good blur job.
I mean, if everyone consents and they're over 18 and they're all human adults.
But they say there was a lot of, like, topless dancing and massage parlors. I can't say that word.
Wait a second.
Yes.
I paused and wrote down the names of some of these establishments.
Oh, please.
So Wild Cherry. Fine.
Great.
The Good Times Club. Susan and Sherry worked there. The Kit Kat Club. A little derivative, but it's okay. The Alaska Bush Company. Oh, no. I hate it. It's, like, not as punny as you think it is, creepy old guy who named it the Alaska Bush Company. Also, the Fancy Moose. Now, I'd like to visit the Fancy Moose. I'm curious because it feels to me like it's kind of our kind of club, like our kind of bar.
Sure.
Where it's a little, like, a little sexy, but a little bit like a lodge. The Fancy Moose Lodge. Like, that could be a strip club, and it could also be, like, a place to get hot toddies.
Susan also wants us to know, back at this point in Anchorage, there was so much cocaine everywhere. She's like,
there was so much money. There was so much cocaine. It was ridiculous. I remember seeing piles of cocaine on tables that would fill this coffee table up.
And we also learned that, like, Alaska at this time had a lot of sex work, and apparently, like, more than really anywhere else in the country at the time.
And it was tolerated there more than in other places. And that seems to be, like, important to how this man was able to do what he did.
Right. And also, there was fucking human trafficking happening. Uh-huh. Because apparently, like, there was this organized crime syndicate in Seattle that was, quote, recruiting women and sending them to dance clubs in Seattle, Anchorage, and Honolulu.
This is bananas. This is how Susan ended up in Anchorage, because she's like,
they were looking for dancing girls. They pay your flight up here. They put you up in a hotel. You'd make really good money. Perfect for a scared girl trying to get away. When you got here, you found out that you had to live in their housing, and every day that you were living in their housing and in their clubs, you incurred debt.
So, like, it's sex trafficking. You're never able to work off the debt. You work for these people. They're basically your pimps. You think you're there to dance. A lot of it then turns into sex work, whether you consent or not. And, like, this was Susan's experience. And she was like, the second I got there, I became like, how do I get out of this?
And so Susan met this murderer piece of shit we're talking about. She met Bob because he bought her a bottle of champagne at the club. She hated him on sight.
Yeah.
He's like, come on, I have a plane. And she's like, yeah, hard no from Susan. Also me. Not getting up in your rinky-dink plane, you fucking weirdo.
You know who would have gone for it?
You.
Patrick. It's true.
Kills me.
I'd have been in that plane so fast.
Yeah, like with the champagne. Come on, everybody. We're like, what? No.
You guys, this serial killer Bobby Boozman, he's got a plane. I'm going.
Stay here with me at the Fancy Moose, I beg you.
No, champagne and airplanes. Bye.
Oh, God. So Susan says she wasn't into doing extracurricular activities like some of the other dancers, which, you know, whatever. And she's like, I wouldn't do that to begin with, but definitely not with this fucking creep who wanted me to go up in his little airplane. But Sherry, her roommate, Sherry did go with him, because the thing about that is that, like, it's just a way out of this life.
Yeah.
And Sherry's like, I'm going. Like, I need to get out of here. I'm going
to
go.
And Susan doesn't even try to talk her out of it. You know, Sherry is just kind of like, will you go have breakfast with me and then walk me to my date? And they do that.
We just got up like we normally do at breakfast, had to walk maybe a block to the little place that she was supposed to meet Robert Hansen in. I just said, have fun. She goes, I will. That was it. See you later. But there was no see you later.
And she's like, all right. Like, Susan's like, bye, have fun, be safe. And she's like, I'll see you later. And Susan's like, and I never saw her again.
So remember at the top of the episode, that body that the cops found? It's Sherry. She's 24 years old, and the cops ID her. And now everyone shut the fuck up and pull over and turn the car off. Turn it off. Don't even have the blinkers on today. I don't want to hear it. Shut up. I need total silence because Maxine Farrell's here. Total silence.
Yes. Silence.
For Maxine.
When I read about this body that was found over in Kinnick area, I knew that it matched what was going on with all the other girls. I said, there's a serial killer. But they wouldn't listen.
Maxine Farrell is fucking awesome. She's from the Anchorage Police Department Homicide Unit. She's like, as soon as she heard about this case, she knew right away they had a serial killer on her hands, but nobody listens to her because she's a woman.
Right, and she was one of two women on the force at the time. There was no locker room for them. They had to change in the bathroom. The men had their own designated locker room and, like, donuts and, like, a fucking spa, basically, and they didn't. The women didn't. And Maxine, of course, heard a lot of comments like, oh, you're working? Why aren't you at home with your children? Do you even have children, you dummy?
Can you imagine?
Yes, I can. But that was Maxine's life. So here's how Maxine got involved in this case. In July of 1980, 2 years earlier, we're in a place called Eklutna, and it's 28 miles north of Anchorage.
We got a call from dispatch and patrol responded, and they went out to Eklutna, and it was the access place for electricians. Electrical workers were going down and found this body. I was sent to it.
And these electrical workers find a skeleton, these human remains. And she knows immediately that the victim is a sex worker. She's like, I could tell by the clothes and the jewelry. And she just knew, like, it's all, Maxine is very good at this, but she also has hunches. And her hunches, yeah. And she listens to her gut. She's like, I know that this is what's going on. And there's no ID, right? And no missing persons report. And Maxine, because there's not a lot of information, she, back in 1980, can reconstruct a face based on what she thought the person look like.
Which is pretty amazing and also terrifying. Those, like, facial reconstructions are fucking terrifying.
We got to, it's 2022. We got to do better. In 1980, I understand. But now, today, can we upgrade?
You know, Maxine is just saying, I wondered who could have done this to this woman because it didn't seem like your typical crime. Like, she's connecting the dots. Like, there's more here than, like, a random murder.
Right. And then soon after that, they call her Eklutna Annie because she was never identified. Soon after she was found, Roxanne Eastland, who's 24 years old, is reported missing, and she is a sex worker. So Maxine's like, hold on a second. I think these two cases are connected.
And then after that, every month she's getting like two or three reports of missing women. She is like the only one seeing like the epidemic of missing women in Anchorage.
Right. And she starts asking some questions, and the cops are like, gosh, shut up. Who cares? They're sex workers. They disappear all the time. And she's like, no. These women are disappearing in our backyard. There's something more here. And also, I don't care if they're sex workers or not. They're human beings and they're going missing and they're murdered. So what the fuck? So she's just like, I'm going to start investigating. Whatever.
And she's amazing because she's like, I went and got the police reports. She learned all about the jewelry that each of these women wore. And she just said straight to the camera,
I was a psychology major, so I knew that a lot of these serial killers kept souvenirs. And I finally made a spreadsheet of it to say, this is a girl, this is what we know, this is what we don't know. By the time I got finished, I had about 10 girls.
She's keeping tabs on the jewelry so that when this whole thing blows the fuck open, as she knows it will, she's going to know exactly what to look for.
And she makes a spreadsheet in the 80s. Wait a second. Like, on paper. Like, not a Google Doc. Like, a spreadsheet. She made it with a ruler, and she made it. Like, Steve must be so proud.
But wait a minute. What is the point of a spreadsheet if it's not doing math for you or whatever?
Organization, sweetheart. You know what? You're already in the plane with the bottle of champagne. Let Maxine and I handle it.
I know this will come as a surprise to nobody. I wouldn't be good at this. That kind of organization, you're making a fucking spreadsheet by hand. No, I can't do that.
Thank God for Maxine, because God knows we're not doing it. Maxine connects 10 missing women to the same serial killer. She doesn't know who the serial killer is yet, but she is operating under the impression that there is a serial killer out there, and she's piecing it all together.
But she takes it to her superiors, and they literally laugh in her face. She says, they thought I was a stupid woman.
So she said, Maxine is here with us today, and she looks directly at us. This moved me and also literally got me on my feet. Like, this was amazing.
I went to my superiors, advised them that there's a serial killer because of the number of girls I was collecting as missing persons. And they laughed at me and they said, no, you're wrong. I felt I was stupid. Stupid woman thinking there's a serial killer. I wasn't stupid.
They thought I was stupid. They thought I was a stupid woman thinking there was a serial killer. I wasn't stupid. No. I'm like, no, you're not, Maxine! No, you're a genius and we need you.
Maxine fucking rules.
I'd love her.
Because we can't have anything nice, we gotta go to church. Ugh. We meet Pastor Wayne Coggins, and he says, and this guy is very nice. I like Pastor Wayne. He says he came to Anchorage in 1979, and he says he remembers driving by a shopping center that had a temperature gauge that said 24 below zero, and he said, what have I done? Why does anybody move there? Anchorage, I'm sure you're lovely. 24 below zero, girl?
I feel like if you're born and raised there, it's kind of like how it all goes, and you kind of know that. But again, to move there, I think anyone would say, what have I done? But like, once you're at a certain age, you're like, my body's just, it just won't adapt. It just won't do it.
No. And then also, like, in the summertime, it doesn't get dark until 2 a.m. Like, what has happened? Alaska, get your act together.
Alaska is wild. I know. So, but Wayne is like, look, I have to, he says he was a big donut fan. So he was a big, he was a regular customer at that bakery.
I met Robert Hansen and his family shortly after I became a pastor at this church. He was a quiet guy, you know, and he was friendly. And I didn't pick up any of the dark side that later surfaced. You know, I didn't pick up any of that. I knew he had a business as a baker. Being a donut fan, that's I've gone in there a few times.
You know who else would have been a big patron of this guy's bakery? Daisy. Daisy would have had this guy figured out in 2 minutes. She's like chomping on her third strawberry donut of the day. Daddy, that's the murderer.
There he is. Yeah, Daisy would go with Mike. Mike loves donuts. And especially if it's like a well, like homemade, you know, like I know we love Dunkin' Donuts on this podcast and I agree. There's a quality to it. I understand those chocolate glazed donuts, delicious. But something about going to like a fresh homemade donut joint, you know?
I'm just saying, Johnny Fairplay, famous from Survivor, who I'm obsessed with, who's now my friend, who listens to this podcast, is campaigning for me to get free Dunkin' Donuts for life because of all the advertising I do for them on this podcast.
He tweeted, he was like, it's unbelievable that Dunkin' Donuts hasn't reached out to this podcast because of how much free advertising they get.
Johnny Fairplay's coming to our Broadway show.
Oh my God, is he really?
He really is.
Oh my God, incredible.
I know.
So Robert the murderer didn't really go to church. Shocking. Although I don't go to church, so I shouldn't make those comments.
Yeah, I love that everyone's like, I met him at church. Well, actually, I met his wife at church, because the thing about Darla the wife, she was fucking awesome. She was like a big woman of faith. She loved to teach the kids school. But the pastor is telling us she was like one of the top teachers of dyslexic children, teaching them how to read in Alaska. Daisy's dyslexic. Like,
yeah,
this is not a thing that was commonly understood in 1980 or whatever the fucking year this was. And Darla's out there teaching the kids who can't read how to read. Darla, I love you. Call me.
Yeah, she's amazing. She is amazing.
I've got the biggest question of the episode.
Yes. Okay.
So we meet this woman, Diana Lynn Hansen. She went to high school with the killer's kids. Her last name is their last name.
Okay.
What?
A little clarity goes a long way, ID.
Because I was like, did she end up marrying him on death row or something?
No. It is no relation at all. But ID didn't say that.
You guys, she's like the friend of the daughter and her name is the same as their last. I could not. Like, I was like, when do we find out that she ended up marrying him after he went to prison?
Right now. She didn't. Right.
At the time, the school didn't know what to do with all these kids that had issues, so they put them all in Darla's class. She was amazing. I have nothing but amazing things to say about her.
But what she's saying is that, like, she was one of the murderer's wife's students. So she's like, no, she really was that awesome.
So now it's April 24th, 1983, and we get more of Bob's interview. And this might be hard to hear. We might not be able to play a lot of it. But he's basically talking about how he, like, took a woman, a sex worker, in his plane to the middle of fucking nowhere. And, like, at this point, the jig is up. Like, she gets in the plane maybe willingly, thinking, like, we're going to go on a romantic date. And in the air, he always, like, pulls a gun on these people and then, like, puts them in handcuffs.
You know, I landed out there and it was all fine. The spot that you land out there, it's all gravel. And there's some woods over here. And then they have a meat shack out here.
And he gets her out of the plane and drags her into what he calls the meat shack.
Yeah, it's like his torture shed that he has in the middle of the wilderness where, like, nightmares become a reality. But he also says, like, it was such a big open space in the middle of nowhere. And again, it's not unusual for people to have planes in Alaska. So these planes would fly over.
Yeah,
and he's describing, again, this audio is his confession. So, like, he's just casually telling these coppers, like, oh God, they're going to find my meat shack. He was like, I considered on more than one occasion shooting these planes down to avoid getting caught.
And then he says, when the plane flies over and doesn't land, he doesn't have to kill this guy. He goes back into the meat shack and he's like, on second thought, I probably shouldn't have told this broad that I called it the meat shack. There's a fucking meat hook that this woman thinks she's about to be mounted onto. And you're in the middle of nowhere. You're in the middle of the Alaskan outback. Oh my God.
And it's like, what an asshole. Like, on second thought, maybe I shouldn't have said meat shack. No, on second thought, you shouldn't have done any of this, you piece of shit.
So September 28th, 1983, it's a year after Sherry Morrow was found. She was the first one at the top of the episode. They find another body. It's a mile downstream. Also, two hunters out moose hunting. Stop doing that.
Yeah, but now the cops are like, wait a second. Our super smart male brains, we are, there's got to be a serial killer. And I'm like, Maxine has been screaming about that for 3 years. You're laughing at her, making her change in the bathroom while you guys have your fucking cigar club and the station. And Maxine is like, what the fuck?
I know. And she says Maxine now is like, well, that's when everything started to fucking change and go in the right direction.
Because Glenn is here. Glenn is an Alaska State Trooper. He's involved now for the very first time. And Glenn God bless him, for whatever reason, is actually listening to Maxine. Thank God.
Yeah, and he wants to start a task force because they're saying there could be up to 12 bodies out there of these missing women that are unaccounted for, and he wants Maxine on his team.
Because he's smart. He's a decent, smart guy. Maxine's been doing this work for 3 years. She has spreadsheets with a pencil and paper on a piece of loose leaf and a ruler. Glenn Smartley's like, her, I want her. First pick on my team, I want her, I want her.
The state troopers asked our chief investigator to let me go, but I was forbidden to work with them. I was angry. I was really angry.
Maxine's fucking bosses won't let her work with the state troopers. Unbelievable.
And this is where we learn, like, we don't learn it here, we learn it down the road. There's all this jurisdictional fucking dick slapping between the state troopers and the local cops.
Jurisdictional dick slapping. Fuck yeah. That's like the most concise way. I've been screaming about jurisdiction bullshit for like 1,000 episodes, and you just put it in this way where it's like, nope, that's it. That's it. Holy shit, you nailed it.
Thanks, girl. The state troopers, like, they're responsible for the entire state, and the Anchorage cops are only responsible for Anchorage, and Maxine is one of the cops, and the cops don't want to give her up, even though they're not using her on the case. Like, the whole thing, when it comes down to, like, they all want to solve it for their own glory. They don't want to work together and just, like, solve it for the victims. You know what I mean?
100%. And it's like Maxine being so valuable worked against her in this moment.
Exactly.
Because they knew that she was going to do the fucking right thing and good work. Like, God damn it. But meanwhile, let's go to the Sunday Singles in the newspaper.
The Sunday Singles was a dating service in the Anchorage Daily News. And that's how I met him, Bob Hansen.
Can you explain to the children what newspapers are?
Newspapers, okay. They still have them now at your local bodega or gas station. But so, you know how Twitter has like a certain amount of characters you can use? It's the same thing in the singles. You only had a very limited space to write out like everything you wanted in a person. So we're here with Karen O'Leary, and she dated Robert Hansen, our murderer and piece of shit. They met through the Sunday Singles.
And the thing to keep in mind here is that he's already married. So bear that in mind.
Right. So he says, quote, he's an adventurous male looking for a lady willing to put on jeans. Join me in finding what's around the next bend. Now, just for Karen's sake, I want the context of it, that she wasn't like, jeans, you say, and like ran to meet this guy. There was more about like, let's go on like fun adventures and be spontaneous and like experience life the way it's meant to be lived in jeans.
And and also, Karen is very grateful to be alive. She knows what she narrowly escaped.
He asked me if I wanted to go for an airplane ride. And I said, okay. Well, thank God the wind was too windy, so he took me to his house.
She says, like, he picked her up. They went to a bar. She said he was nice. And, you know, they're having a drink. He invites her back to his home where he lives with his wife and children. And I guess he just knows they're not going to be there or whatever. And so, like, they go down to his fucking murder basement where he's got, like, taxidermied heads of animals all over the wall. I understand that this is a thing that people have. To me, it's a murder basement.
Yeah, and everyone calls it a man cave. And I'm like, can we not? This guy's a murderer. He's, like, trying to murder Karen right now. Don't say man cave. It's a hell house or whatever.
It's a fucking hell house. That's exactly what it is. So they're down in the basement and they're, like, smooching. They're necking. Oh, my God. And he asks her if she wants to make love on the bearskin rug. And she politely declines with kind of a chuckle.
Rate check. Just anything to get out of there. Maybe later. Ooh, I simply must be going.
But, you know, she says he goes quiet and then, like, she leaves. Like, nothing happens.
Like, in a twist, he respects that, which is like, oh, okay.
We're going to come to learn that he respects women who are, like, looking for love. And he thinks that women who are sex workers are devalued humans. He can do anything he wants to them. So, like, meeting somebody for a date through the funny pages makes it so he can't kill them. But meeting a sex worker at a club or on the street means that, like, he can murder them because they're valueless.
Well, I was going to save it, but I'll say it now. The flaw in that plan, asshole, Robert, whatever the fuck your name is that that's all to justify to yourself because you sought out those sex workers. You made it so that you could feel better about what you were doing. So please, I don't want to hear it. Don't try to turn it, Bobby. Is it that it's all about, like, who's good and who's not? If we want to talk about who's good and who's not, here's a mirror.
So it's June 13th, 1983. We meet Greg Baker. He fucking rules this guy. He's a white cop in Alaska in the 80s. And I put my stamp of approval on this guy.
Okay. Wow. Great.
Because he believes Maxine. We'll get to that in a minute.
Oh, yes.
He's on patrol with another officer, Wayne Vance. And Wayne Vance is here. Hi, Wayne. And they're saying it's 3 or 4 in the morning, and like they get this insane call. This is bananas.
We got the call from dispatch that a white female was running down Fifth Avenue naked and handcuffed.
And we learned that, like, some good Samaritan in a truck picked her up, but then went and dropped her off at a hotel, still naked and in handcuffs, and then skedaddled on to work.
I was going to say, what kind of hurry is this guy in?
I know.
What are you, unless there's someone giving birth in the backseat of your car, totally. Where you simply must get to the hospital, or you have a limb falling off, or someone is maybe dying, right. And you yeah. stop to save this poor woman in peril. Can you wait? And not just like dump her at the Woods I Motel, know. It's called the Woods Motel. This poor woman, because we learned she's 17 years old.
Her name is Cindy Paulson. She's 17. And the cops get there and we hear Cindy on tape. And she's like telling us her ordeal.
I was on corner Fifth and Denali. And the gentleman here rode by, pulled in the parking lot, and stopped me with this man, and he offered me $200 for a job in the car. And I said, fine, no problem.
A man picked her up, offered her $200 for, like, sex work in his car. So she says yes, gets in the car, he pulls a fucking gun on her and then handcuffs her. And he tells her if she yells for help or tries to get out, he's going to shoot her. He takes her, again, back to his home where he lives with his fucking wife and children, takes her down to his murder room. They, again, call it a man cave. Stop doing that.
Stop doing it.
And he, like, for 5 hours... tortures and rapes this woman in the basement of his home.
And she says the entire time it's happening, she's plotting a way to get away, because she says, this was not my time to die. This is not how I go. And she's like thinking of how to get out of here. So Robert's plan, we learn, is to take Cindy to his torture cabin in the woods. He's like, hey, we'll spend the weekend. It'll be great. Then we'll come right. back. And she's like, yeah. nothing about you is great. Cindy is 17 years old and she knows enough. She goes, if I go to that cabin, I'm never coming back.
And she knows it. And she's fucking handcuffed. Like, what is she going to do? So they get in his car. They get to the airport. And he says to her, I got to go put a special seat in the plane so I can tie you up. I'll be right back.
Get to the airport. And like he said, yeah, please. Seated so he could tie me up in the plane. I knew I wasn't gonna live. I mean, the man, what he did to me, he had to kill me.
So she takes this opportunity. He's like, BRB. She literally runs for her life.
Yeah.
She runs handcuffed, naked. She doesn't give a fuck. She runs for her life.
Yeah, this is where the truck driver stops and is like, I can give you a lift to the motel, but I really got to get
to
work.
As far as I go, girl. Far as I go, sweetheart.
And so this is insane. Like, Officer Greg, who I love, asks her, and he says the right terminology. He wants her to come to the hospital to take a sexual assault exam. And she agrees. And as they're passing the airport, she's like, I don't know if this matters, if you guys care or not, but that's the plane of the guy that was trying to kidnap and kill
me. Is this anything? But that was where I was supposed to go to get murdered. Is that anything at all? Cindy fucking hero.
So they call the airport and they're like, that plane with that like tail number, who does that belong to? They're like, his name is Bob Hansen. Here's his address.
There they go. Off they go to his house. He's like, hey fellas, what's up? Some coffee? What do you want? Hot toddy? What's up? Super calm, super cooperative. He's like, you want to see my man cave? There's a bearskin rug down there and some handcuffs if you're interested. What's going on? Happy to chat. He's like, sure, I'll go down to the station.
And Detective Greg says, like, the best part about it was as soon as he started talking, I knew he was lying. I believed Cindy.
I was sure he was involved. Because of that, I was sure he was lying to me. I learned early in my years in law enforcement that if somebody will lie to you, that's the best thing in the world. One, they can't remember the lies. And two, lies are easy to prove, you know. False.
Cool, calm, and collected Greg. I love this guy.
Right. And so the cops search his house, to which I'm like, I guess him being the owner of that plane is as good as a warrant, because they're just like, we're just knocking over the yeah, they're just searching everything. So they go down to the rec room, the torture chamber, the man cave, whatever you want to call it. And there are like tons of hunting trophies. But more importantly, it's exactly how Cindy Paulson described it. So they know that she was there. She, of course, is telling the truth. And they didn't find any physical evidence, but they knew that this is where Cindy was. But they found a hidden pistol, which is interesting to them.
Yeah. And Officer Greg is like, I fucking believed Cindy. And I was like, what are the next steps? How do we get this guy? And then he says, but the investigator, who I guess outranks him, believes Robert. And he says, she's just a sex worker. She probably upped her price afterwards and he refused to pay. And this is just a squabble between a sex worker and a John.
Like, I don't understand why men do this. Like, what's it to you? Do your job. Like, just investigate it for 5 seconds.
And what's not being said here is that what he's really saying is, I'm not going to waste like town resources on a sex worker. Like, we don't care about
like
that.
Someone like her. Right. Yeah. Who cares?
So it's 3 weeks later. Officer Greg says he hasn't heard anything on that investigation in 3 weeks.
I noticed the last report was a disposition of suspended. In other words, there was no more investigation going on about that case at all. And I just, that bothered me, you know, because, I mean, damn it.
He knows the investigation was paused, that nobody cares. And he goes, I mean, damn it.
Yeah, he's like, the official term is like suspended. And like, Greg is super pissed. So Greg starts doing what Maxine did, independent of Maxine, like not knowing that Maxine had the spreadsheet with the ruler and the pen and the pencil and whatever. Right. But he basically does the same thing because he believes Cindy and he knows that there's something here. So he does a deep dive on Robert Hansen.
Yeah, so we go back 12 years and this is what he finds. We meet a guy named Ron Rice from the Anchorage Police Department.
Ron Rice goes,
my first encounter was Robert Chris Hansen was probably the first arrest he had in Alaska. That was when he tried to abduct a female in late 1971.
Huh, the first time I met Bob, let's see, it must have been, oh yeah, it was that time he tried to abduct that woman. What was it? 71?
And the thing about this was that this woman that he abducts is not a sex worker. She works in real estate. And on his own confession tape, he says,
The first time I seen her was downtown. I had, an attraction to her. I wanted to talk to her. I got in my car and I followed her home.
I saw her downtown. I thought she was hot. I wanted to talk to her, so I got in my car and fucking followed her home.
I followed her home.
No. You do not get to fucking do that.
No, and you know what else you don't get to do? This next thing. He shows up to her house with a gun in his hands. She opens the door. He points a gun at her. She screams. The roommates hear him. Call the cops. He runs. It's chaos down here, Tom. The cops picking up within 30 minutes. He's arrested. And Ron Rice is like,
comes across as kind of a wimp when you talk to him originally. You know, he denies everything, but his head is down like that. He's not really looking at you, and he's just an innocent person.
He doesn't seem like the type. But I'm like, we have to stop with the he doesn't seem like the type, number one. We got
to
stop.
But when this guy's been arrested for, like, kidnapping a woman at gunpoint, why is he on the street to do all these murders all these years later? Why wasn't this stopped back then?
Right. Well, we'll get into it. But one thing about Ron Rice, he sounds exactly like Philip Baker Hall. Close your eyes and listen to him. He's from that guy. He was, like, the host of the kids' game show in Magnolia. He was in Boogie Nights, Zodiac, like, Seinfeld, Curb, so many things. But if you close your eyes, it's Philip Baker Hall telling the story.
That's so funny. I love that your go-to IMDb reference for him was Magnolia. That's like one of my top two favorite movies.
Amy Mann did the soundtrack. Come on.
Oh, God.
So he's out on bail, right? Like, he's just out on bail waiting for a court date to be set for this horrible thing he did.
Of course, because he's a white guy. They let him out on bail, out to terrorize the community.
Patrick, it's just a woman. And nothing bad really happened. Just trauma for her to live with for the rest of her life. That's all.
But this one cop was like,
I got an impression that he was going to rape her. And that's when I decided to start that new book that we did with color photographs of possible sex offenders, and he was actually number one in that book.
This cop just does this. He just decides to make a photo book about the sex criminals.
So while this piece of shit is out on bail, this woman, Patricia Roberts, is abducted at gunpoint, and she's taken 160 miles from Anchorage. Ugh. He sexually assaults her. Robert in the audio is like, I was more scared than she was. Fuck off. And so, like, now he's escalating because this is what they do. So Patricia Roberts was his first sexual assault victim. But she lives. And the cops bring her in. They have that guy's photo album, that photo book of, like, all the creepy guys. And they show it to her, and she's like, oh, Robert Hansen, that's him. 2 seconds flat, she IDs him. That's it.
So he's arrested, and he, of course, is like, no, she's just a sex worker. This was just like a sex work transaction gone wrong. They make a deal with this fucking piece of shit where they're like, we're going to get you on the gunpoint for the first lady, and we're going to drop all the charges about the kidnapping and the rape of that other lady.
Yeah.
And he's like, great, bada bing, bada boom. He gets 3 years in prison, and that's it.
And see, this was a lesson to him, because now he learns how to pick his victims.
I think he learned from those early cases. And the thing he learned is choose your victim so that you will maximize the likelihood that the case won't even be handled. You won't even have to deal with it. No one will believe it.
And that moment was a catalyst for everything to come next. And so many lives could have been saved if that didn't happen. So now we're back with Greg Baker. He's the cop who believes women, thank God, yeah. One in a million.
In 1983, give this guy an award. What's up, Greg Baker?
And independently, because he doesn't know who Maxine is, he's doing exactly what Maxine did. He's like doing all this research and he turns it over to the troopers and they listen to him because he's a man, basically. Like, he literally handed over exactly the kind of work that Maxine did. But then they're like, now, wait a second. Now, hold on.
But the thing we learned is that Greg is he's an Anchorage state cop. So he, like, turning it over to the troopers, he could have gotten in trouble, but he doesn't care. He's like the one cop right. That like wants to fucking get the guy, as we always say.
They're like, oh my God, Greg Baker, thank God you're here. Yeah. We had nobody else around giving us this kind of information. Thank God.
That really turned it for Flothy. That was for him the missing piece of the puzzle. This is it. This is our guy.
And they say the troopers had already been looking at Hansen as like a troublemaker, but all of this information from Greg Baker is like what blows the thing wide open, basically.
And it's what makes everyone realize, holy shit, he's a serial killer, and there are a lot of other women that he harmed in this.
Yes.
And now it's not just like a one-off, so to speak, but now they're like, holy, this guy's fucking prolific, and we gotta get him. So
yeah.
Now they know he's a serial killer, they're searching the house. Fuck it, they're searching the house.
And they trick him. They trick him into coming down to the station. They're like, hey, do you want to come down and talk about the murders that we think you did? He's like, absolutely.
Because he loves talking. He's a talker. They used it against him. Amazing. So as they're, so he's at the station. They're doing their thing. Now Maxine and everybody else. So finally they're like, oh, Maxine, I know we were total assholes to you, but we really need you to help solve the case.
Can I just say, it breaks my heart because Maxine is at the house and she's the one who describes the kids.
And made contact with Darla and two kids. The little boy was horrified. He was not crying. But he was just horrified. And the little girl, she was just standing there with tears streaming down her face.
These poor fucking kids and the wife who, like, just wants to teach dyslexic kids how to read. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're saying that, like, they're going through the house. They have a warrant. They can be there. But they're afraid that he's going to come back any minute and be disruptive or whatever. So they got to do this quickly, and they're not finding anything. And so finally, like, the only part of the house that hasn't been searched is the attic. I'm like, I don't know why you didn't start with the attic. Like, that's where you start in a search like this.
The basement and the attic, wherever there's any kind of, like, what does he have, a crawl space? Like, let's go to the, you know what I mean?
So they go up to the attic and, like, one of the detectives just, like, pulls back some insulation and finds rifles. And they instantly know that it's the same kind of rifle that would have killed the first two victims that we talked about here, the ones with the shell casings. Mm-hmm. And so right away, they have something to tie him to the murder. So, like, that's a big moment.
And the big thing they were looking for, too, I mean, the weapon is gigantic, but they were looking for the trophy so that they can connect him to all of these other murders. It's the jewelry, and that's why Maxine's there.
Yeah.
And then, also in the insulation, they find the jewelry.
I could see bracelets and ankle bracelets and necklaces. What we wanted to find, we'd found. There's no doubt in our mind it was him.
She identifies all of it and she says to us, what we wanted to find, we found. And this dude is fucking arrested immediately.
Yeah, he's arrested immediately. But they say that, like, Cindy Paulson, that 17-year-old who was, like, naked with the handcuffs that they found at the hotel, she's the only witness. So without, like, an outright confession from him, they're saying that, like, this still isn't an airtight case. And then they go through the evidence that they seized from the house, and one of them was an aviation map. And there's all these little X's. Like, there's 21 X's on this map. Oh, my fucking God.
Right. And so it turns out that he was marking the burial sites and the murder locations on these aviation maps, and it's everything they need. Like, he did it all for them.
Right. So when they bring him back in and they're questioning him, he finally admits to, like, the murders that he knows, that they know that he did. He doesn't know that they have the aviation map.
Right.
So when they get to the end of that and he's like, that's it, I'm all done, nothing else to see here, they throw the aviation map down in front of him. They're like, we know there's 21 bodies total, because we know you marked them all off. And he just, like, spills the tea. He ends up admitting to 17 of the 21 murders.
Because they say, if you keep talking and tell us everything, we'll only charge you with the crimes that we brought to the table. So everything else you tell us about from here on out, you won't be charged with. And for them, it was just, like, for the sake of closure for everyone else, right? They just wanted to know. So that was the deal. And he's like, all right. He confirms that he's a fucking evil monster, a total piece of shit. He gets 461 years plus life for the murders of Sherry Morrow, Paula Goulding, Eklutna Annie, who was never identified, Joanna Messina, plus the kidnapping and rape of Cindy Paulson. And the remaining six victims have never been found or identified. And it ends where it's like he's in prison forever and ever. 461 years plus life. Like, plus my God. I know that that's just like on paper, but it feels really amazing to say. And what's even more amazing, 2014, he died at 75. I feel nothing. I feel happy. Feels nice. He's dead. Fuck him.
Oh my God. Wait, we did. What is it called?
It's called Butcher Baker, Mind of a Monster from ID.
You guys, it's a really good one. There's a lot that we had to skip over because we just like couldn't get it all in. Go watch this doc. It's really, really well done.
Yeah, it's very good.
Also, come see us on Broadway April 11th. We are sold out, but if you have tickets and you're not coming, please get in the Facebook group and find a home for them. I need every seat filled. Johnny Fairplay's going to be there. Some other fucking cool people are going to be there that we can't really talk about.
Yeah.
We are making a really, really great show for you. We're so proud of it. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Join us on the Patreon if you want to hear six episodes about this insane woman digging up bodies in the woods because she just can't help herself. The series is called Relentless.
It's
from
called
Discovery
Relentless
Plus.
And is it ever? We also did Lula Rich and Heaven's Gate and The Vow and Don't F With Cats and Tiger King. We're over at Chippendales having a... Please join us at the strip club at Chippendales. We're having a grand old time.
And if you want to hear me defend why I think I would have been a body under a driveway during the Gacy doc, go listen to it. I think I'd be there. I think I would definitely
It pains
be there.
Me to say, but I think you would too. And I love you, and that's why it's hard for me to say.
How am I still alive? How have I survived this long?
I don't know how Gacy didn't get you, honestly. I don't, to this day.
You want me to crawl all the way in? I'm going, gone, Gacy.
Why don't I? You know what? I'll handcuff myself, sweetheart, and I'll just crawl myself into that crawl space.
What are we doing next, girl?
Oh, so next we're doing Crime Scene Times Square. So this is, it's three episodes on Netflix, the same people who did Cecil Hotel, but we're going to break it up into two episodes. Sometimes we do that.
And we're doing a double drop. So we're going to release episode one on the regular feed and episode two on Patreon in the first week. And then in the second week, episode two becomes the episode on the regular feed. So patrons get both episodes at once.
Yeah.
And we love you. Follow us on Instagram, True Crime Obsessed Podcast. I'm at Patrick Hines _. You're Jillian with a G on all the things.
I am. This was fun. This was we recorded this on a Sunday afternoon, and at first we were like, wow. And now look, we got a lot of anger out, we got a lot of rage, we love Maxine, the guy's dead. Come on, we had a nice time, I think.
Win-win-win all the way around.
That's right.
We love you guys.
We love you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
The whole world is attracted to Times Square, but in the late 70s, Times Square was considered an atrocity.
Firemen were responding to a report of a fire in a West Side hotel room. They found much more than they had anticipated.
It was the hotel room from hell.
You had the smell from burning flesh. The smoke was thick. They crawled into the room, not being able to see.
I had covered crime. But I had never covered crime as salacious and as evil and as brutal.
What sick son of a bitch could do something like this?
The demon barber of Fleet Street.
What's a girl gotta do to get a well-placed blur job in this joint? Am I right?
I always say, if that hottie Jeffrey Dahmer hit on me at a bar, I'd be a head in the fridge.
You always say. That's the thing you always say.
Silence!
For Maxine.
Bring back my girls. I also love, too, like, whenever you see those BuzzFeed listicles, like, here's what Cleopatra looked like. Here's what Jesus looked like. And he wasn't white, you guys.
Honestly, Jerusalem, give me a fucking break. He was never white.
And because it's called the Outback, we can do the bartenders in, like, assless chaps.
Sure. Well, that's, like, come on. For the P&G home of bars, it'll be like a chain, but they'll all be different. But you just know you get the same caliber of service. And usually that is like lots of Cosmos and a bunch of butts.
A bunch of butts.